This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Israel says that Hamas also violated the truce by a shooting attack yesterday in Jerusalem that killed four people, and Hamas fired rockets. Israel then responded with airstrikes on Gaza.
That was a reporter Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem on the resumption of fighting between Israel and Hamas. Details coming up also. Today is World AIDS Day, and more than 30 people were feared trapped when a makeshift mine collapsed in Zambia. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Israel's war with Hamas resumed in full force today, with airstrikes hitting targets in the Gaza Strip minutes after a week-long truce expired. Israel dropped leaflets over Gaza City and southern parts of the enclave, urging civilians to leave their homes to avoid the fighting. In Israel, sirens warned of incoming rockets in southern communities, a sign that militants also restarted their attacks. The renewed hostilities heightened concerns for Palestinians, many of whom have been displaced by the war, as well as about 140 hostages still in Gaza. A White House National Security Council official today said the United States will continue to press for extending the truce. Yesterday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Israeli officials and urged them to do more to protect Palestinian civilians as they seek to destroy Hamas. Under the week-long truce, Hamas militants released 80 Israeli hostages and about 30 foreign nationals in exchange for 240 Palestinian prisoners. More humanitarian aid was also delivered into war-devastated Gaza. Qatar, which has served as a mediator along with Egypt, said negotiators are trying to restart the ceasefire. Israel's retaliation for Hamas's deadly October 7th raid has killed thousands of Palestinians, uprooted most of Gaza's 2.3 million people, and led to a humanitarian crisis. The United Nations said the collapse of the ceasefire would worsen an extreme humanitarian emergency. Other world leaders also have expressed dismay at the return of the fighting. Earlier today, I spoke with reporter Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem for an update on the situation.
The latest is that the ceasefire expired at 7 a.m. this morning, Israel time, after Hamas did not provide Israel with a new list of hostages that it was willing to free in exchange for Palestinian prisoners. Israel says that Hamas also violated the truce by a shooting attack yesterday in Jerusalem that killed four people, and Hamas fired rockets. Israel then responded with airstrikes on Gaza, but Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, is here, and he has warned Israel to try to be more careful about civilian deaths. So far, the death toll, according to the health ministry, which is affiliated with Hamas, is over 14,000. And it's not clear how many of those are civilians, but in any case, we're talking about thousands of women and children who've been killed in Israeli airstrikes. The Israeli army dropped flyers on the southern city of Khan Yunis, telling people to flee even further southwards to Rafah. The whole south of Gaza is very crowded right now because more than a million Palestinians have fled their homes in northern Gaza in front of the fighting. At the same time, Israel released a map that it divided Gaza into lots of small areas and gave each one a number, and said that it will warn civilians where there is active fighting so that they can stay away from those areas. It's not clear exactly how that's going to work and if that's going to really stop civilian deaths. We have reports of several dozen Palestinians killed today in Gaza from Israeli airstrikes.
So, Linda, in all this, what happens to securing the release of the hostages?
Well, that's exactly a good question. So far, by the way, more than 100 hostages have been released, most of them Israeli, also about 17 Thai workers who have gone back to Thailand. There are still an estimated 136 hostages in Hamas captivity. The numbers change as Israel kind of gets more information. For example, they today said that three of the adults who had believed to be hostage in Gaza were actually dead. They found some remains or something that indicated that they had died. That means that the hostage release for now is put on hold. And the truth is that there's concern that as the fighting increases, the hostages could possibly be killed by Israeli airstrikes or by Hamas. Some of these hostages, there are still 9 children, by the way, including these 2 little redheaded boys, the 10-month-old and the 4-year-old, the Bibas brothers. And there's concern growing that they are, along with their mother, that they are no longer alive.
The ceasefire is concerned. The Qatari government was involved in it. The U.S. was involved in it. What are plans for a future ceasefire? Are negotiations continuing as the fighting goes on?
Yes. I mean, Qatar has held talks with both sides to try to get the ceasefire put back in place. You know, the ceasefire lasted for 7 days. And during that time, every day, hostages were released. Palestinian prisoners were released. A lot of humanitarian aid, very needed, got into Gaza. So, and there was sort of hope that this 7-day ceasefire would eventually turn into a long-term ceasefire. Now, all along, Israel has said that it has not completed its military goals for this operation, which were to make sure that Hamas can never present a military threat again, and that Israel was going to take advantage of the pause to get the hostages out and then was going to start the fighting again. So Israel said that it was never meant to be a long-term ceasefire. At the same time, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, you know, said to Israel that Israel may not have months to get rid of Hamas. Israel says that if it stops the fighting now, it's basically stopping the fighting with a weakened Hamas, but still Hamas still in control of Gaza. And that's something that they're not willing to do. So there are contacts to renew the ceasefire again, but at least so far, they don't seem to be producing very much.
And lastly, Linda, we're back to square one now. So what is the mood where you are?
So I think the mood in Israel is still supportive of the war, very worried about the hostages. You know, the hostage family forum has been very successful in making this very personal. There are posters of the hostages every place that you go around the country. At the same time, I think most, according to polls, most Israelis support the war against Hamas. They want to see Israel get to a situation where Hamas can no longer present a military threat. In Gaza, of course, there's, you know, a feeling that, you know, the fighting is very dangerous. It's very hard, both physically and mentally. There's a lot of stories of children in Gaza who are terrified, who are wetting their bed. And this past week of a ceasefire has given them a little bit of a break, has allowed a lot of humanitarian aid to come into Gaza. So, of course, the vast majority of Palestinians in Gaza want the ceasefire to continue.
Guinea-Bissau's army today said the situation is under control after gunfire was heard overnight in the capital Bissau in clashes between members of the National Guard and Presidential Guard Special Forces. The clashes began after National Guard soldiers freed Economy and Finance Minister Suleiman Saidi and Secretary of State for the Treasury Antonio Monteiro, who had been detained in an investigation. Police questioned them for several hours about the withdrawal of $10 million from state coffers, according to military and intelligence sources. Alvaro Andrade of the VOA's Portuguese service has been following the news and spoke a short time ago with VOA editor Kate Pound-Dawson. He tells her the incident could be linked to preparations for next year's presidential election.
Now we're going to have the Deputy Chief of Staff of the Armed Force, General Mamadou Touré Nkrumah, says the situation has returned to calm, and that everything was caused by the action of the commander of the armed forces, the National Guard, Vitor Chongo, when ordered to release 2 members of the government detained by the police. The Minister of Economy and Finance, Suleiman Saidi, and the Secretary of State for the Treasury, Antonio Monteiro, were placed in preventive detention on Thursday after being interviewed by the Attorney General because the loan that the payment the government approved loan around $10 million to 11 businessmen The minister was heard in the parliament last Monday, and he said everything is legal because it's normal operation. 30 days after the police invade the minister of minister of finance to investigate in this operation, and yesterday after being interviewed by the attorney general by some prosecutors, they were arrested. And this morning, or not morning, the night, the National Guard, who depends from the Minister of the Interior, went to the prison and released the Minister of Finance and the Secretary of State of Treasury. And then the armed forces send the President Battalion to rescue the Minister and the Secretary of State of Treasury and put them back to the jail. And this is the point. We have new clashes between the government, because the National Guard depends on the government, and the Presidential Guard, who depends on the President of the Republic. Essentially, information I have, the residents have returned their habits. They are on the street. The protection has been reinforced around official buildings and around the presidency, the general staff and the judicial police, and also the government building in.
There have been military coups in the past in Guinea-Bissau. Are there concerns that this was an attempted coup?
We can see now, it not seems like a tentative or beginning of the coup, but see a new chapter in this fight, if you can say, the fight between the president, Oumarou Sékou Mbalo, and the PAIGC, the major party now, the ruling party, led by the Domingo Simões Pereira, former prime minister. Because both of them are running for the presidency next year. And the government is a coalition led by the PAIGC, the ruling party, which has great support in the parliament. And the president of the parliament is the president of the PAIGC, the party in power. The attorney general is appointed by the president of the republic. It depends on the government, but the president has used the attorney general, who is trusted by him. And the attorney general was named by the president before the new government took place in August. The National Guard depends on the Minister of the Interior by the government, but the Presidential Guard depends of the president. We have a conflict between the two major forces in Bissau, these two personalities, and I think we're going to see in the future some more episodes like this.
That was VOA Portuguese managing editor Alvaro Andrade speaking with VOA's Kid Pound Dawson. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. More than 30 people were feared trapped today in the collapse of a makeshift mine in a Zambian region known for illegal open-cast digging for copper, according to the French news agency AFP. Home Affairs Minister Jack Mwimbu told Parliament there was a tragedy brewing. The mines ministry made no comment, saying it would make an inspection first at the site of the Chingola region, about 400 kilometers north of the capital Lusaka. Zambia is one of the world's largest copper producers, and Chingola is in the country's copper belt region. World AIDS Day today is focusing on the work that communities do in fighting the epidemic. AIDS activists say that's particularly important in Africa, which has the largest population of HIV/AIDS patients. James Shimanyula prepared the following report on South Sudan's efforts to help patients.
The World Health Organization says of the 34 million women and men living with HIV today, the vast majority, an estimated 23.5 million or 69%, live in sub-Saharan Africa. And of those, 60% live in Eastern and Southern Africa. They include Swaziland, Lesotho, and South Africa. UNAIDS is leading the global effort to end HIV and AIDS, the disease it causes, as a public health threat by 2030. The agency says it is reminding government that HIV remains a threat and is working to end the stigma that many HIV patients experience. Lai Lole is the director of South Sudan Network of People Living with HIV/AIDS. He says stigma remains a problem in Africa's newest nation.
We need to have zero discrimination on HIV and AIDS because of the lack of the education. They do not understand what HIV means. They begin discriminating people in the workplace, in the family. And this creates a stress. And that stress alone is a disease because somebody is isolated by people.
Peter Garang is the head of AIDS Network, a non-governmental organization in South Sudan. The United Nations estimates 73% of the country's population is under the age of 30, and Garang says many young people have mistaken ideas about the disease and how to prevent its spread.
Though we are the majority, it is something very difficult as young people to accept the fact that HIV exists and that we should go for appropriate measures of preventing ourselves.
New treatments have changed AIDS once a death sentence into a chronic disease and the patients live decades with the virus. However, the UN AIDS program says increased funding is critical to increase awareness of the impact of HIV on people's lives and to improve the quality of life of people living with the illness. In a 2023 report, UN AIDS says that HIV infections have dropped by 57% since 2010 in Eastern and Southern Africa. Without providing figures, UNAIDS says the number of new HIV infections is decreasing in South Sudan, though problems still remain. Lord Dutty is the country director of UNAIDS in South Sudan.
Globally, of all people who are living with HIV, 67% have access to treatment. In South Sudan, it's only 18%. So we are lagging behind. We need to rally everybody around and ensure that we are all addressing the issues.
This year, UNAIDS is calling for community-led organizations to deliver 30% of testing and treatment services and nearly all services for people at high risk of HIV, including women. For VOA Africa, I'm James Shimanyula in Nairobi, Kenya.
The U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR, was established in 2003 by then-President George W. Bush to address the devastation caused by HIV/AIDS, particularly in heavily affected regions. Since then, over $100 billion has been invested in the global HIV/AIDS response, saving 25 million lives and preventing millions of HIV infections, according to U.S. government data. Ambassador at Large John Nkengosong, U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator and Special Representative for Health Diplomacy, tells VOA's Lenocht Moudou that PEPFAR has been a cornerstone in the global fight against HIV/AIDS.
If we just imagine 20 years ago what HIV was doing on the continent of Africa, it was a symbol of hopelessness at that time because nobody knew what to do. The public health experts and doctors could diagnose HIV, but that was the end of the story. It was a death sentence. PEPFAR came in and in 20 years has saved about 25 million lives, prevented HIV infections from infected mothers to infants in the tune of over 5.5 million. So I don't know of any intervention in the history of infectious diseases in this decade that has led to such a significant impact and outcome.
When we look at communities, public and private partnership, what makes a program like PEPFAR strong when it comes to implementing it on the ground? Because it's one thing to have the money, to have the idea. Yeah. It's another thing to take it to the people.
Absolutely. The country's leadership has to be strong and committed. Just a few weeks ago, the former president of Botswana, President Festus Moha, wrote a piece on the Hill, the news magazine. And he said, the title of that was, "Thanks to PEPFAR, our country was going to be extinct. That is so powerful. That is leadership. President Festus Mohar was the first president who went to the United Nations, took the floor and said, HIV/AIDS is going to extinct my country. I need help. So that is country leadership. It requires sustained engagement because the results we've seen in PEPFAR is because we've been there for 20 years, supporting the leadership role and commitment of countries. It requires partnerships. Partnerships that PEPFAR is supporting countries, but you also have other partners like the Global Fund working there, the World Bank and others working together. But very importantly, it has to be driven by data. It has to be driven by evidence. I mean, who is infected? Where is that person infected? So that we apply the resources very efficiently.
How do communities take ownership of their health and be part of the solution when it comes to fighting a pandemic, an epidemic like the HIV/AIDS crisis, even drawing from the experience with COVID as well?
During HIV response, where we've made progress, and countries that have made significant progress are countries that have embraced the community very early on. Without the communities, there is hardly any vehicle that can reach a broader audience in these communities that we are trying to serve than the community themselves. It should actually be community leadership, not just community engagement. When community leads, we make progress.
What do you see as some of the main challenges today in Africa when it comes to the fight against HIV/AIDS?
We've come a long way in partnering with several governments in Africa to fight HIV/AIDS. But for instance, one challenge we have is the adolescent girls and young women. The rates of new infections in some countries is about 6 times higher amongst adolescent girls and young women than in the corresponding age in boys or men. Second, we have to look at children. In children, we are still looking at 50-50-50, which is 50% of children who are infected are aware of their status, 50% who know their status are under treatment, and 50% via immunosuppression. Whereas in adults, in some countries, they are, in about 8 countries in Africa, they have exceeded the 395. That is 95% of people knowing their status, 95% on treatment, and 95% via immunosuppression. We've made great progress, but that progress is fragile. That if we do not maintain those millions of people that are on treatment, HIV will come back.
That was Ambassador-at-Large John Nkengasong, U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator and Special Representative for Health Diplomacy, speaking with VOA's Leonard Moudou. Madagascar's Constitutional Court today backed Andry Rajoelina's re-election victory, rejecting opposition complaints of fraud. According to the French news agency AFP, the court said Rajoelina secured 59% of the vote on November 16th, winning a second term without the need for a runoff. The court said turnout was barely 46%. 11 opposition candidates have already said they will not recognize the results, alleging the election was riddled with irregularities. 10 boycotted the vote in protest. The opposition claimed Rajoelina was not eligible to run, this after media reports revealed he had acquired French nationality. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.